This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's 7:14 and you're listening to the Evening Edition with Lynn and Sharmila. And we're now talking about Malaysia, My Second Home, because earlier this month, the Home Ministry announced the reactivation of the program with new entry requirements. And various groups have criticized the changes as being too drastic, potentially harmful to our country's economy. So that's the angle that we want to explore.
So mainly the changes that have caught a lot of attention include the fact that the minimum monthly income for applicants has been increased from 10,000 ringgit to 40,000 ringgit. They're also required to have a minimum fixed deposit of 1 million ringgit. Previously, it was 150,000 ringgit. And they've also talked about the fact that they are now required to be in Malaysia for 90 days minimum every year. So naturally, all this has brought up questions of why these changes were made and what the end result might be.
Yes, and how that in turn will impact how many people want to be here and how much money we make from this program, which has been successful in the past. So to explore this, we are now crossing over to Jayant Menon, Visiting Senior Fellow at IC's Yusof Ishak Institute. Jayant, thank you so much for speaking with us. Can you start off by outlining the economic benefits that we've seen so far from the MM2H program?
I think the MM2H program has been successful. It's brought in a lot of people with purchasing power, with good incomes into Malaysia to settle there, you know, to set up homes there and also to spend their money at home and creating multiplier effects on the domestic economy. It's difficult to actually measure the true or definite impact, but I think one estimate I've seen suggests that the benefits up to last year before the pandemic was 40 billion ringgit. So this is very substantial. So so it's clearly beneficial economically. And of course, it's probably got other spillover effects as well. I mean, it increases, you know, cultural ties with other countries through these people coming in. And in a multicultural society like Malaysia, that's always a good thing. And it can create diasporas as well around the world over time and give Malaysia, you know, more profile overseas for its tourism and other things, well, which will be hopefully returning soon after we get on top of this pandemic.
So you mentioned a couple there, but specifically which sectors benefit most from programs like these?
I think, you know, the property sector is clearly one that will be affected. It'll benefit property developers that want to sell, you know, their units. But we have to be careful here not to end up pushing up prices or reducing affordability of these properties for domestic residents. You know, housing is a basic need, and we don't want there to be, you know, very sharp rises in housing prices in the more affordable ranges especially. But I think mostly a lot of the demand has gone in towards the higher end because of the criteria imposed on the program. So it hasn't competed with low or medium housing as such, but it would have benefited the property sector the most. But also, I mean, other sectors, there are lots of multiplier effects in play. When you increase your population size, especially with people who have relatively good income and good purchasing power. But there's also benefits to other services, including health services, especially if they're older, older people coming in. So there's a broad range of sectors, mostly services, but I think property would be the main sector affected.
So to come to the heart of it, right, the program is set to be revived in October with new criteria that many are saying seem too restrictive. What are your thoughts on these new conditions?
Yeah, so I think some of the changes that are being brought in, one key change is the increase in the monthly incomes to 40,000 ringgit. I think that's probably a bit steep. I mean, it's a very high monthly income. It's certainly very high if you're considering it a retirement income. So I think we need to be careful. Clearly, they're doing this to try and increase the so-called caliber of applicants to be from the higher income groups. But this might be a big jump from the current previous 10,000 cutoff to 40,000, right? So raising it four times suddenly in the wake of a pandemic where, incomes all around the world have fallen sharply, unemployment has gone up, poverty has increased. We're dealing with all kinds of vulnerabilities. This is the worst time to be doing something like this if you're trying to increase the number of people coming back in to a country recovering from the pandemic. So I think that's probably not a good move, especially at this difficult time.
So the counter argument, though, is in addition to what you mentioned about that caliber of applicants, is that these conditions also prevent abuse of the program. Now, is that a valid argument? Are there other ways that this could be imposed instead?
I think there are other or better ways to check for abusers. I mean, the important thing is to do your due diligence and to do it in a way that is open and transparent and free of corruption, right? You cannot have the process corrupted. That's what you need to be wary of, raising the minimum income and so on is not the best way to handle these issues. I think you also need to have the right government ministry in charge of it. I think the Ministry of Tourism is probably the better place to have this managed efficiently than the Bureau of Immigration, although there are other issues to be considered, of course. But policing it more efficiently, doing the due diligence and making sure you have an open and transparent system is the right way to reduce or remove abuses, not putting in unreasonable income cutoff limits to try and achieve the same aim. That's a very inefficient and maybe counterproductive way of going about it.
So part of the reason that this program was reactivated was to help our economy recover. And I think we've touched on this, but with these new conditions in place, is the program likely to achieve that purpose?
I think we have to realize that, a lot of things have changed following this pandemic. For one thing, that is going to make it more difficult to attract people coming into the country. And this is true generally in all countries, but, the poor will face greater competition or greater choices. And countries are competing, to try and help their recovery from this horrible pandemic. So putting in, more stringent criteria at this time is probably not a very good idea. So I'm not too sure that the timing is right for this kind of these kind of changes. Some of them are probably going to have less of an impact, but like I said, raising this minimum income fourfold from 10,000 to 40,000 ringgit is going to severely choke off supply. And that's not going to be very helpful in a post-pandemic situation.
So various critics, including the Johor Sultan, have said that these new conditions are likely to put off investors. Why is this a concern? How would these criteria impact our investment potential?
I think the Johor situation is slightly different. There's a lot of investment from Singaporeans And also, you know, going into the real estate sector in particular in Johor, some of which have royal connections and all that. So there's a different set of issues involved in that case. But I think the general point about, you know, putting up these new conditions at a very difficult time will put off investors. And that's very true. And, you know, we can find that, you know, they have other choices around the world, and we should be competitive. And this is not a time to be making ourselves less competitive.
So how then do the conditions for MM2H compare against other foreign resident programs in the region?
I think this program used to be quite competitive. I mean, there were a lot of benefits, including import tax exemptions on vehicles and so forth. And Malaysia, you know, provides a very attractive place for a lot of foreigners to settle in. You know, it is very affordable in many ways. The cost of living is competitive when it comes to many other countries. But other countries are working harder also to attract people, and they will in a post-pandemic new normal. Thailand is an obvious competitor that's trying hard. Their tourism sector has been very badly hit, of course, and they'll be looking to recover that very soon. And they have a similar program, and so does the Philippines. And the Philippines program also was suspended, like the Malaysian one. They were concerned about abuses, again, coming from a large inflow of Chinese investors and so on. But they've now revived that and changed it slightly also to try and deal with some of those concerns. But yeah, the bottom line is that, you know, it was very competitive. These new changes will make it less competitive, and people have many choices in this region and beyond. South America is another destination for a lot of retirees, especially, and high-income retirees. So it's not just this region. I mean, we operate in a global sort of situation when it comes to these types of flows, and we have to be competitive globally in order to succeed.
Jayant, what would you like to leave us with?
I think the point, general point that I would like to make is that these sorts of programs are very helpful in terms of, you know, promoting domestic demand and creating, you know, a lot of spillover benefits for the local economy. And they should be encouraged, but they need to be competitive. They need to actually work in a way that benefits the local economy as well. Yet they need to be competitive in attracting people to come here. But they're also not a substitute for underlying fundamental reforms that are required, right? Or underlying problems. You know, Malaysia is a net importer of labor, but it's a net exporter of skills. So we find that, you know, in net terms, there's an outflow of skills every year. And this has been going on for a couple of decades at least. And this is also true of capital. So those outflows of skills and capital need to be arrested. And there are fundamental changes in the economy required in order to achieve that. This program can help in sort of offsetting some of those effects, but it is not a panacea, and it can't reverse those effects, and it can't substitute for the need to make fundamental macro and microeconomic reforms in the economy, and the government needs to rise to that challenge.
Jayant, thank you so much for speaking with us. That was Jayant Menon, Visiting Senior Fellow at the IC's Yusof Ishak Institute, talking to us about the economic impact of the changes that have been made to the Malaysia My Second Home program. In case you missed it, we covered earlier how there's been a 300% increase of the minimum monthly income required, as well as a 600% 5% increase of the minimum fixed deposit required. So we are narrowing down that pool, even as other countries are staying competitive. So we'd like to hear from you. What are your thoughts on this? Is it a good move? You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. And coming up after the 7:30 news today, we are going to be reviewing the latest from Netflix, but more importantly, the latest from Sandra Oh, and that is The Chair. So keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my. BFM 89.9, the business station.